This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of the panel session from the recent BFM Health and Living Live 2017 by AIA Vitality. This event is presented by AIA, the real life company.
Our third session is In Search of a Cure for Dementia, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Now, the holy grail of research in studies for dementia, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's is a treatment that either slows, halts or reverses premature cell death in a particular part of the brain. It is this progressive degeneration that causes the symptoms we see. While there remains no cure, it's essential that people have access to the right support and services to help them live with these conditions. Now, as usual, there's a short video to help explain what's the next topic all about. Please enjoy the video.
The first thing that comes to my mind when I think of dementia, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's is
old age. And it would remind me of the people in my neighbourhood because one of them has this Alzheimer's and he would usually get lost. And it reminds me of him a lot.
I think of family members who suffer because their loved ones are suffering from these illnesses and it's not so much the person who actually has the disease.
I think there are very specific challenges with people who suffer from these diseases, and knowing how to treat or rather how to care for these people are actually very important.
From my personal experience, I didn't know how to deal with my grandmother. I think if I were to know what was she going through at the time, then probably I could like talk to her and then be more accommodating to her needs. Yeah.
And I think that's why it's really important to have like awareness on these particular issues as well, because if we are more aware of it, then we might be able to preserve a quality of life for older people for a longer amount of time.
Okay, and now as usual, please help me welcome our distinguished speakers. Please give a round of applause for Associate Professor Dr. Tan Mo Pin, Consultant Geriatrician, University of Malaya. Dr. Lim Shen Yang, Consultant Neurologist, University of Malaya. Dr. Bharati Venkatasalam, Consultant Psychiatrist and Geriatric Psychiatrist, Pantai Hospital, Kuala Lumpur. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, Neurogeneticist, University of Malaya. And to moderate this session, we have the brains behind this event. Literally, the woman of the hour, the absolutely beautiful, gorgeous, sexy, intelligent, hardworking, accomplished, and most importantly, the woman who will be signing my check. Ladies and gentlemen, the rock star, Meera Sivasani!
We're back after lunch. Alzheimer's, dementia, and Parkinson's. I think something we really don't know very much about, as I mentioned earlier in my opening address, but we have a power group of people here. So if you want to ask questions, do it as we go along. Just raise your hand and we'll be happy to answer them. You can tell over 1 year, for those of you who came last year, age has caught up with me. I need to wear glasses now. Okay, I have to put my pride aside and wear these glasses. Okay, I'm going to dive straight into this topic. Dr. Tan, I'm going to start with you. Often we can't make that differentiation between dementia and Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is actually a type of dementia. Could you just elaborate a little as to what dementia really is?
Well, most people will know dementia as, I mean, we always insult people saying the demented old person. I mean, someone who's forgetful, who might not be behaving appropriately in situations. But actually, the whole process of dementia, even though we now understand it more than ever before, is still not that well understood. We now believe that dementia starts at birth. So from the point that you're born, things start happening to your brain that will actually determine whether you develop clinical dementia or not.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then why can't we tell now at this stage whether we're going to get it or not?
Well, that's the question. We probably can if we looked hard enough. There are already tests that will tell whether certain people have an increased risk of getting dementia, genetic tests, which Aslina will be able to tell us about. But we won't do it to individuals at the moment because we don't have a cure. So it's actually unethical to know about a disease that you might or might not get when you don't have a cure. Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Azalina, on a genetic level, what's going on?
Hi. Hello, everyone. At the genetic level, I think if in cases where there's a strong family history, then there is a chance to be able to test for certain genes. So it is known that there are a number of genes, about 3 genes are well known for being associated with the familial form of some of the late onset neurodegenerative diseases. And you could get screened for those. The problem is that the genes that we know about only account for about 10% of families that have these conditions. So there's 90% of patients who perhaps ask to be genetically tested, but we don't find anything in the known genes. So then the question is, what's going on in those families? So that's what the current research is going on at the moment. For patients who get late onset diseases, there's less of a clear-cut link to an inherited pattern of the disease. And in those cases, for both Alzheimer's and also Parkinson's, there are some genetic risk factors that may increase our susceptibility to developing these diseases. But in the case of, for example, Alzheimer's disease, only 25% of people who have Alzheimer's have a form of a gene called ApoE gene. But not everyone who carries the form that gives you the risk of developing Alzheimer's will go on to develop Alzheimer's. So genetically, there's a lot of research that's going on, but there's still a lot that we don't really understand yet.
And when is it Alzheimer's? When is it dementia? How do you tell the difference?
That's a really difficult question, and we're getting closer at answering that question. So previously, the first dementia patient who was described by Alzheimer's himself, Alois Alzheimer's himself, had typical changes in her brain that actually, they are called neurofibrillary tangles as well as amyloid plaques. You see them in the slide when you look down the microscope. And that kind of Alzheimer's disease, we now know, rarely happens. So when we look into a brain of someone with dementia, a lot of things actually are going on. So they can have a little bit of the protein that actually marks Parkinson's disease. They can have a little bit of protein that marks Alzheimer's disease. And then when you look at the blood vessels, they've got thickening of their blood vessels or even blockages of their blood vessels that are actually strokes. So there are actually numerous things that come together to cause that memory problem. So there's rarely a pure Alzheimer's dementia, and we've come to actually realise that now. But we do have scans. We can do scans for amyloid, that will actually show who has more amyloid plaques and who has less. We can also take the fluid out from your spinal cord, and we can measure the amount of amyloid in that to tell whether someone's more likely to have Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, what about Parkinson's? How does that fall into this mix, Dr. Lim? Parkinson's? How does that fall into this whole neurodegenerative disease? I mean, Dr. Tan was saying that, you know, you can even have thickening of some part of the brain, which could indicate Parkinson's as well. Is that how you diagnose?
So Parkinson's disease is, after Alzheimer's disease, the second commonest neurodegenerative disease. And many patients with Parkinson's over time do develop dementia. So if you follow patients long enough, over 10, 15, 20 years, perhaps about, you know, even 50% or more can develop dementia in the long term. As Dr. Tan has mentioned, in these various degenerative diseases, there are different protein signatures. So accumulation of different proteins, for example, you know, you've heard about Alzheimer's, and in Parkinson's disease, it's alpha-synuclein, which aggregates in brain cells, and that's thought to cause the clinical features of Parkinson's disease.
And the clinical features are tremors we always associate with Parkinson's disease. Is that necessarily true?
So tremors are very common, and many patients seek attention and have Parkinson's diagnosed when they experience tremors, or it's noticed by family members or friends. But not all patients with Parkinson's have tremor. About 80% do, 20% don't. More importantly, actually, with Parkinson's disease, it's a condition that is characterized by slowness of movements. That is the key feature, okay? Slowness of movements, and typically resulting in difficulty walking and muscular rigidity as well, or stiffness. Now, this is not something that necessarily patients may feel, but when we examine patients, this is something that we look for, so muscular rigidity. These are the three major features that allow us to make a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease.
This is an edited recording of the panel session from the recent BFM Health and Living Live 2017 by AIA Vitality. This event is presented by AIA, the real life company.
Dr. Bharathi, you're a geriatric psychiatrist. Dementia and Parkinson's, my goodness, I think coping with one is bad enough. What more, two or three? What do patients struggle with most upon diagnosis?
When patients first receive a difficult diagnosis, which is really going to impact the outcome of their lives and the quality of their lives, definitely the first thing they undergo is grief. And there's a lot of grief about the loss of their roles and how things are going to change for them in the future, how it's going to impact their loved ones, how is this going to change the planning of their lives and their decision-making. And we noticed that for neurodegenerative diseases, it's a very difficult condition to have because it's very chronic and it's very long drawn out. If you ask most older people what they dread the most, surprisingly, it's not cancer. Would you agree? It tends to be dementia and tends to be that sense of loss of identity and loss of their faculty. So there's a lot of fear, there's anxiety, anger, and a sense of the unknown, to be able to face your mortality and how that's going to pan out.
We spoke about caregivers this morning, and I spoke to clinical psychologist Paul Jambunathan on caring for the caregiver, because nobody really thinks very much about the emotional health of the caregiver. Now, people around patients who have been diagnosed with dementia, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's struggle the most. Would you agree with me? Because most often they've lost their sense of, ability to do things and the ability to think, really. But emotional behaviors. I was reading that although you may think Alzheimer's patients don't feel anymore, they actually do. Could somebody elaborate on that? In terms of, you may have a fading memory, but you still feel, Dr. Bharathi?
Very much so, because persons living with dementia have normal feelings and responses the very same way all of us do. But what is changing is their ability to cope with those emotions, to problem solve what those emotions cause, and to come up with strategies to console themselves. So when something bad happens or when something distressing or upsetting happens, they are unable to perhaps process what caused it. And that's horrible, because then you don't know what to do about it. But all you remember is feeling bad. And that lasts longer than the factual problem that arose before they felt bad.
And that can also present with emotional behaviors, which sometimes you don't really understand why they react in the way that they do. People with a dementia know whether they're being treated with respect or not, Dr. Tan.
Yeah, it's a huge problem in our society. I mean, it's very Asian. As soon as someone has been labelled with an illness, they lose all their autonomy and they are considered useless in a sense. So that's why people fear the dementia, because dementia is a very chronic disease, and you don't start... one day you don't have dementia, next day you're diagnosed with dementia. It doesn't mean you're suddenly turning from useful to useless. So it's... Nowadays, we're getting patients who are living 10 years with dementia, and a bit like Parkinson's disease, the first few years of dementia should actually be what we call the honeymoon period. So it should actually not be, it shouldn't actually affect your life that much. You can actually adapt a lot of what you do in your daily life so that you can still function. Okay, Ronald Reagan famously actually was still president of the United States when he started developing dementia. But the White House was able to compensate for his forgetfulness. But there was nothing wrong with his decision-making ability. So he was it's a learned process. So often we have patients' relatives taking car keys away from them, and we'll have to say, give it back. And they'll go, how can you do this? Because they can still drive. You don't actually lose the ability to drive until you're quite far on in your disease, because it's a learned behavior. The problem with dementia is learning new things, usually. And everyone's dementia is different. So if we're able to actually, okay, we're working hard to prevent it, but at the end of the day, we're not that near a cure. But even getting dementia isn't all doom and gloom. You can actually enjoy your process a little bit more. And that's what we're trying to achieve by actually coming out and sharing this with other people.
Yeah. So is Donald Trump suffering a neurodegenerative disease by any chance? The symptoms seem much worse than Ronald Reagan, actually.
But I think Bharati will be able to.
Yes, Dr. Bharati.
I don't know whether it will be an insult.
He's a geriatrician, I would think.
Yeah. I don't know whether it will be an insult to dementia patients to say he's got dementia.
Or any patient.
Coming back to Parkinson's, one of the things, Dr. Lim, that we look out for, as I said, is tremors. And are we in any way misdiagnosing Parkinson's? Because once we see tremors, we assume it's Parkinson's. Is that necessarily the right way forward?
Well, it's a good start. It brings many patients to medical attention. Of course, you're quite right. Not all tremors are caused by Parkinson's disease. You heard from the previous panel about other medical conditions causing depression. Well, medical conditions can also cause tremor. For example, a patient with, you know, an overactive thyroid. So probably the commonest cause of tremor is a condition called essential tremor, or ET, and there's a long list of other causes for tremor. The tremor in patients with Parkinson's disease is often quite characteristic in the sense that it occurs primarily at rest, so, you know, this kind of shaking movement, frequently in on one side, so one hand or one leg maybe affected first before the other side becomes affected. But I think it's useful, you know, for the public to have in mind that, you know, if you have a tremor, then it should be something that requires, you know, at least a further look at.
Do you see malaise coming to you late?
Yes, I do.
Is there such a thing as early diagnosis when it comes to dementia, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's?
Yeah, so that's a very good point. So to answer your first question, do some patients present very late? The answer is yes. And you'd be surprised, even in urban centers. You know, you have patients who may have become very disabled by their Parkinson's disease with stiffness and slowness to the extent that, you know, all of the basic activities of daily living, eating, toileting, showering, dressing, all of these things have to be done by the family, and yet they're not on treatment. So you do see this on occasion. And then there's also, you know, I think this is probably quite an Asian thing as well, an aversion to Western medications and all things natural being superior. I mean, that's also an issue that we face frequently in clinic, convincing patients of the need to take medication. Coming to your second point, is there such a thing as early diagnosis? Now, this is something which has become very prominent in our field. Right now, the way we diagnose Parkinson's disease is when a patient comes with all of those problems that I mentioned before, slowness of movements, tremor, stiffness, difficulty walking. But by this stage, you know, if you look at it from a scientific point of view, about probably 50% of group of neurons in the brain which produce dopamine are already degenerating. And so there's a lot of interest in trying to diagnose Parkinson's at much earlier stages so that when we have effective treatments that can prevent or delay the progression of disease, then it would be, of course, better to administer these treatments earlier.
Okay.
So just to give you a very brief example, it's very common for patients, if you ask them, to have had dream enacting behaviors many years before they are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. So this is called
RPD. So they act out their dreams?
Right. So this is the situation where a patient shouts and punches and kicks, usually very late at night. And this is something which is very, very common as an early sign of Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
That's just one example.
Sure. We have a question.
Say hi. My name is Annabelle. I'm studying occupational therapy. And I actually have two questions mostly related to Alzheimer's disease. So we know now that there have been so many studies to go with Alzheimer's disease and trying to find a cure. But my question is, I mean, through my research, it's usually a lot of drugs are approved in the first stage and the second stage. But on the third stage, in clinical settings, most of them usually fail. And I just wanted to ask on a more technical question on why. And the second question I wanted to ask is that lately, in March 2017, someone created a drug called Intepirdine, and it's more to trying to improve the memory of Alzheimer's patients. So my question is more of, instead of trying to find a cure for Alzheimer, even though that's really important, should we also try to focus or move our focus towards improving the symptomatic treatment of Alzheimer's instead?
Well, actually, Annette, can I take on your first question? What she means is when drugs come on, you have phase one, which is how the safety profile of the study, etc., etc. And then phase two, they do a much more small study. And then phase three is when we do a clinical trial, so we put it on real patients in settings, and that's when the drugs fail. Basically, are mortified now because suddenly the penny dropped to all patients. All the academics who's been trying to join the race for the cure for Alzheimer's disease. Basically, we are treating a disease because when it's all the damage has already been done. So we know the brain does not regrow, does not regenerate. And by the time someone has symptoms with Alzheimer's disease, most of the damage has already been done. So even if you remove the cause of the disease, they don't get better because the brain does not regrow. So there's now a move towards finding out ways of identifying pre-dementia. That means knowing people, finding out whether someone has dementia even before they manifest the clinical symptoms of dementia. Now, that's a really, really difficult thing to do. And I think we've lost a lot of time because we were actually gunning at the wrong point. And now all the focus is on the other
things. Pre-dementia. So would you say drugs so far have failed?
Yes. In fact, we have still don't have what we call a disease-modifying agent. But I think perhaps the symptomatic treatment is more Bharathi's area, so she might want to talk about that one.
Dr. Bharathi?
So there are what we call foundational medications for certain forms of dementia, which are related to the chemicals of the brain. For example, dementias that are due to Alzheimer's disease, even dementias due to Parkinson's disease, and another form of dementia called Lewy body dementia. So dementias that are caused by a change to the structure of the brain, for example, a severe head injury, they don't really respond to the available medicines that are around today. The available medicines that are present in current research all over the world, Professor Tan Maupin said, they're not disease-modifying. They are only symptomatic. Those medications are expensive. But the evidence is mixed on whether it can really improve the quality of life in terms of changing the person's memory and behavior. However, there are some patients who do respond to this and whom the family members have found that the patient who is suffering with dementia seems to be a lot more amenable and easier to care for. So this is quite a controversial topic because it's, of course, you know, dictated by things like public health policy and dementia policies and health economics, right? When you mentioned the role of symptomatic treatment, because medications are limited, the way to really go is to delay the onset of dementia. The longer we can delay and offset it, the older we are when we get it would be better than getting it earlier. So a lot of the cases that are present in the world, I mean, there are at least 7 or 8 potentially modifiable risk factors that people have which they could do to delay the chances of them developing dementia. There's nothing that's a cure. There's nothing that's 100% prevention. But we need to address those things like lifestyle factors and how each of us can be accountable to our health.
So what are these lifestyle factors? Play mahjong, perhaps?
That's a really good way.
That is correct.
I'm not sure that I answered the last question.
So. What else? What else do we do? Come on, I'm desperate.
Exercise.
Now. The three
exercise
of you are
exercise is
saying,
very important.
Okay, exercise.
I think recently there was I read a newspaper article to say that, you know, elderly individuals should really actually being in nature itself. But I think not just people who have dementia, but, you know, across the board, really, you know, there have been many studies that sort of say that just being, you know, somewhere green, you know, they always talk about all the new development that's being made in Kuala Lumpur and also in PJ. They're always saying, you know, open green spaces and everything. And that really does have an impact, I think. And taking exercise, not necessarily just in the gym. I mean, you can also do that. But then also, you know, do go out to parks, you know. Because when you go out to a park, you also have other things that happen. You meet people, you interact with them. And that also helps keeping your brain active.
Okay, delay the onset of Alzheimer's. I think dementia or even Parkinson's. A lot of us here are middle-aged. What do we do now?
Okay, there's a study called the finger study, okay? And finger study actually looked at really totally changing your life across the board, yeah? And it's not anything a Malaysian will desire, I have to say, because you really have to change everything you eat, you have to exercise like crazy, and you have to take up a new skill. You have to learn a new skill in your middle age. And we're going, oh no, but you know, now I'm already middle age ready. My children should do everything for me. Well, no, your children are doing a favor by saying no. Okay, so those kind of things, it's quite revolutionary. I think Bharati wanted to join in about the finger study as well.
I mean, it's everything, like all the blue zones in the world show that's very simple, you know. I mean, a lot of people come with us for a magic answer, like, will mangosteen juice help? Or taking like a bottle of coconut oil every day.
Yes, what about this coconut oil thing?
100 tablets of ginkgo in a month help me? But, you know, it's really simple, you know, it's really no magic answer. It's moving naturally. It's having the right tribe. What does that mean? That means having the right connections, nurturing relationships, eating well, and exercising. These are the single most important factors which cut across board to cut down the chances of what we call vascular disease, blood vessel diseases. Whatever that affects your heart is going to affect your brain. So whatever that you're doing well for your heart will protect your brain.
What I'm hearing is I just have to do whatever I can and hope for the best, really, because you can do all the right things and still land with this problem, right? Yeah. Dr. Aslina, you've done research with Dr. Lim on Parkinson's. What was that about?
We've been doing some genetic studies on Parkinson's disease, but I just sort of wanted to come back and say something to continue what Dr. Bharati was saying. That actually, Dr. Lim Shen Yang has actually been doing some really interesting work on the gut microbiome as well.
Yes.
So looking at how healthy your gut is and how that relates to our brain health. And so there is some sort of recent, quite strong evidence to say that, you know, you have to, exercise and keep your brain active, but it's also, you know, very important to keep your gut active as well. Maybe Shen Yang can say something a little bit about that later.
Fecal transplantation by any chance? That happens. They do it in Singapore, I understand.
They actually do it in quite a lot of the world, but it's not for Parkinson's disease, I believe.
Okay, what do we mean by healthy gut?
Yeah, this is... actually, I wasn't expecting to speak so much with being the only guy here, so I thought I'd just sit back and learn a few things.
Typical guy. When's the girls to do all the work?
Exactly.
What's new, really?
You've caught me out. Over the past 5 years or so, at UM, we've embarked on a series of studies looking at the potential influence of the gut on Parkinson's disease and related degenerative conditions. So there's a lot of interest now, not just in PD, but in Alzheimer's disease, in, you know, autistic spectrum disorders, and in, you know, whatever, diabetes, obesity, inflammatory bowel disease, and so on, looking at the potential impact of the composition of gut bacteria on health and disease. So we found, for example, that in our patients with Parkinson's disease, the presence of Helicobacter pylori, which is a common bacterium in the stomach, and also of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, these are associated with worse movements in our patients with PD. So this is the work of my colleague, Dr. Tan Ai Hui at UM. And more recently as well, we found that patients with multiple system atrophy, or MSA, so this is a relatively rare disease, but one which is very much like PD, but much worse in terms of the severity of symptoms and the rapidity of progression. These patients also had a very distinct alteration in their gut microbial composition. So, but we are, I think, not quite at that stage yet from this knowledge to be able to recommend, you know, fecal transplantation or, you know, probiotics and exactly what kinds of bacteria to ingest. So, but this is, I think this is an interesting way forward.
This is an edited recording of the panel session from the recent BFM Health and Living Live 2017 by AIA Vitality. This event is presented by AIA, the real life company.
Where do we go from here, really? We still don't know anything. Is that too... we have a question.
Good afternoon. My name is Hari. I have an aunt who has Alzheimer's, and so sometimes she cannot remember if we ask for something. By the time she reaches the kitchen, she forgot what we have asked. But we assume that if there was a harsh word spoken towards her unintentionally, we assume that because she cannot remember, she won't feel the hurt after a short while.
Isn't that nice?
But I hear you just now that it's not true. They do feel the hurt for a long period, but they may not remember why. Is that right?
Yes, that is true, actually, because the way a caregiver is able to cope and deal with their loved one's dementia is very important, because it's a lot about body language, how you sound, your eye contact, the tone of your voice, that could go a long way in soothing a person with dementia. So often what we have is a lot of family members come in who are new to it, who are new to this. So it's a skill. No one is born to know how to manage this. So we have family members coming in who would correct patient with dementia a lot. And that's very, that's like making the patient with dementia feel very small and feeling like an infant. And the older person can really quite feel that. The other issue is also being confrontational. It's a lot easier actually to go with the flow. The more you're able to adapt to the needs of the loved one is able to manage their dementia better. It's less stress for the family, it's less stress for the patient. It doesn't mean that people are complacent. It's being able to match that individual where they are. We have family members who come who are also new to this, who for someone with, let's say, very moderate to severe stages of Alzheimer's dementia, and I'm sure we all see families who are just new, okay, coming in with like, oh, I think, you know, my mom should be doing Sudoku every day. And, you know, the mom can no longer remember how to do that. So that would be quite stressful for that individual. So, yeah, we have to match the person where they are and slightly, maybe just slightly higher.
So they are sensitive to emotional cues of people around them. Okay, question.
Hi, I'm Angeline, and I'm all about for the prevention of any of these mental disorders. And now that, well, urban happiness means that more and more of us are living in condos and apartments, and I find one very disturbing thing about living in an apartment is the banning of companion animals. I feel that is a real detriment to anyone's mental health. And I'm just wondering what the medical profession is doing to maybe guide or steer the authorities that be, that they cannot ban companion animals because of the direct impact banning of these animals will have on the mental health of its occupants.
Fantastic. Let's talk about pet therapy and people who suffer dementia, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Does it make a difference?
it's well documented that having a pet really helps. And there's several things about having a pet. Because having a pet means that you've got something that's dependent on you. And that gives you a purpose in life. So you wake up every morning because you have to feed them. You have to actually be responsible for them. Without you, they will actually not be able to live. And that's really very special. And the other thing is just the companionship. But even in people who are not familiar with animals, for some reason, you know, you have these institutions where they bring in a dog and then everybody seems so much calmer. Those kind of things have been described. But unfortunately, we can't really influence condo management. I fight with mine all the time. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, pet therapy goes a long way. I wish I could provide the statistics. It's exactly as Prof. Tan Maupin said. It's also that feeling of touch and that feeling of being loved unconditionally. You know, a pet or even a companion therapy animal goes a long way. But in terms of legislation here, it has been quite hard because I think you've known that even certain guide dogs are not allowed in shopping complexes and things like that. And the other issue with condo living is also connection with people, and this era of digital age has really altered social interactions with people. I would say there's a lot of factors involved here.
Yeah, that's why I say buy a house before you go home. Question, yes. Can we take a few questions and answer them together?
I'm Karyen, studying biomedical science in Taylor's University. So actually a lot of research that have been done on nutraceutical and functional food, that they say that it could actually reduce the symptoms of Alzheimer's or even dementia. Yeah, and what we could actually do to raise awareness if it doesn't.
Sure. Thank you. The next question?
All right, I have two questions. Firstly, we often think of Alzheimer's, we often associate it with old people. Is it possible that a person who is much younger, let's say in their late 50s or early 60s, developing Alzheimer's? And secondly, just now, there's a lot of mention about how relationship or socializing helps with this illness. Can I understand in what way it helps? Because there are a lot of people who are introverts, so to ask them to be to socialize, it takes a lot of effort on their part.
That's interesting. And the last question?
Hi, my name is Kamalesh. I'm studying psychology in Sunway University. And my question is this. It's more on a personal scale because we all know how important it is to get early diagnosis and to actually help the person who's actually getting it, the treatment for any of these three diseases. Because, like, what I'm asking is how is it that us, the younger generation, actually can help convince our parents or grandparents that they are actually facing a serious mental disorder that is incoming.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Who wants to take on the first supplements, I think, is what she was referring to. Does it really help?
Yes. Actually, when my patients ask me, I say, go ahead, try anything. If you find the cure, tell me and we'll get rich together. Basically, the only thing we've shown to help is ginkgo biloba, but in people with established Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia, it seems to reduce the behavioral problems and also slightly improve the memory by 2 points. Okay, but the rest we have not been able to get adequate concentration in a human body to actually make any difference. So if you have money, go for it. If not, then don't bother because it doesn't really help at the moment.
Okay, the next one, what if you're an introvert and you know you don't want to socialize? How does that impact the brain?
Being an introvert is more about a person's personality and how they've always been. It doesn't mean that introverts are more prone to get dementia compared to a non-introvert or an extrovert. But it's also a little more about connection with someone, connection with loved ones and having nurturing relationships. An introvert doesn't mean that they are isolated. It's really about social isolation and not wanting to have activities with family, not wanting to venture out with family and, you know, even developing just
one or two really strong connections. Socialization also means conversation and feedback, and it prevents the chances of depression. And depression is a risk factor for the development of dementia now. So that's how the link is there.
Okay, yeah. And what about the people who are in denial?
I think that's a really very big ethical issue. Yeah. And our difficulty in our society, because we are a semi-developed society, is that actually making the diagnosis of dementia is a huge ethical issue. Because in the kampongs, having a diagnosis doesn't necessarily help you, but doesn't mean that your life is any worse. So I put that to you if you kind of think about what I actually mean.
There was a question on young onset Alzheimer's disease. And of course, with neurodegenerative diseases, these are mostly age-linked, but there are many examples of patients with Alzheimer's and even with Parkinson's disease who have young onset. You know, it's not at all uncommon to see patients in their 30s or 40s coming with symptoms of clear-cut Parkinson's disease.
But that's rare in younger people?
I would say it's rare below the age of 40. Above the age of 40, it's uncommon, but it's not rare.
Michael J. Fox was one of them, isn't it?
Yeah, he was 29 when he developed the first tremor in his finger.
Okay. Yeah. We have a question here from the audience. How do I deal with my father with dementia with violent tendencies?
So, going back, it's a bit related to the other question on how to get professional help for your loved one who has that. Firstly, has he had a proper evaluation? Is there a diagnosis in the first place? And are there other contributory medical factors that could be causing his violent behavior? You know, sometimes you'd be surprised an older person with dementia, with just a urinary tract infection or a respiratory tract infection, sometimes their behavior gets worse. Could it be something in the environment, like a change of caregiver or grief or a loss of spouse? So it's very important to look for the trigger for the violent tendencies and to understand what is that unmet need of a person with dementia, because sometimes in the moderate to severe stages, there is no ability to really communicate or express what is bothering them. So it takes a bit of guesswork for the family to see what kind of precipitated that. Is it just that he's missing his old work or his old occupation, or, you know, not even having maybe gone to the bathroom to move his bowels for many days? Or could it be that the dementia is progressing and this person is now having delusions towards their loved ones, like theft or infidelity, thinking that his 80-year-old wife is having an affair with the 50-year-old neighbor next door, you know? So the actual symptoms have to be looked at, and a professional help has to be sought in a safe manner, because not all medicines are safe for older people and for persons with dementia.
From a caregiver point of view, I think it's true that we do need to identify the reasons why they're behaving that way. But from a caregiver point of view, when your loved one is going through these very violent tendencies, you also need to develop coping mechanisms so that you don't then become, you know, retaliate. Because I think, you know, in situations like that, you know, emotions run high. And so, you know, you need to find ways of distancing or making sure they're okay, but then you also sort of have to have a breather, you know, because if you're trying to fight fire with fire, it's just going to escalate. So as a caregiver, you need to develop ways of how to cope with those challenging behaviors as well.
Which brings me to what we all struggle with. Are our aging parents with dementia, Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, are they better off at home or are they better off in nursing homes?
So my mother has dementia. And she lives at home with us. And that was really a choice that we made because we felt that we just wanted her close. It's a really personal decision, I think. That's not to say that if you send someone to a nursing home, that doesn't mean that you are a bad child. It just means that sometimes that's the only way that you know how to manage.
Yeah, doesn't necessarily mean it's better care.
Yeah, you just have more support, perhaps, right? So, for example, I had a friend who had a father and also her mother at the same time had cancer. And so you can imagine it would be really difficult, you know, to try to... And she was the only child, so she had to sort of, you know, help to manage both medical conditions. It was really challenging. So, you know, you can imagine that when you're in that situation, you have to weigh what is the best in the end for the parent. If the alternative is that the parent is going to be at home and you're going to lock them in their room because there's no other support for them, maybe it's better that they go to a nursing home where they will have, you know, the support and people to care and look after them, to feed them, etc.
And ignore everybody else who says you're a bad child. It's your life as well, isn't it? Question.
Because there's been a comparative study more on like the idea of caregiving, there's been a comparative study that shows that caregivers who are helping dementia patients are more prone to depression than caregivers who are helping depressed elderly. So I just wanted to bring back the question on how we can help these caregivers and what we can do for them.
Okay, next question. Is there one over here?
We've talked about stimulating the person with dementia, giving them exercises, socialization, and medication. Where do you draw the line when the person with dementia isn't into it, or it causes more stress for the person, even with medication, for example? Not having medication and the person is happy and calm, whereas taking medication or stimulation causes them stress or anxiety.
Dr. Tan, you want to start with the second question?
Well, that's a very emotive question, I can see. A lot of that boils up to a very interfering Asian mentality. I spent a large chunk of my life in the UK, and when I come home, I find that people seem to want to tell me what's good for me, you know? I cannot decide what's good for myself. Yeah, so I have my kids and I bring them up my way, you know, I never hit my kids, and apparently it's very bad, you know, you spare the rod, you spoil the child. I was like, but you know, that's abuse. So the whole point is, I'm probably not the right person to actually teach this, because I'll tell you that the older person has autonomy, and once someone has reached adult age, they should have a right to make a decision what they want to do. Even patients with dementia, even when they become non-verbal, so they can't communicate, can often actually exhibit choice. So it's very important you give the person choice. You can't say, today we're going to do Sudoku and you will sit there until you do your Sudoku, otherwise we're not going to do anything, because they will rebel. Because they want to have the autonomy, and they've always made the decision in the family, and suddenly you want to take over. So there has to be not even a compromise, there has to be an understanding of what the older person wants to do. And I think to me it's really difficult for our society to accept. So we have a long way to go. Asking them what they want to do is actually a very basic step. Yeah. And if they don't want to do anything, that's fine.
I think they're also to know that there's some battle, you know, you don't have to win every battle. You know, some battles, you don't want to bathe today, okay, it's all right, you know. We'll bathe you tomorrow. You know, it doesn't have to be that they have to have a bath every day. You know, sometimes you just...
But it's really difficult, because if you don't do it, then your auntie will come and say, why you didn't do this? Yeah, so
yeah.
It's so difficult. It's a whole societal issue.
Everyone's an expert.
Maybe just adding on a little bit to that question is that when dementia progresses, there's also an understanding that there is a symptom called apathy that increases, and that's a very real behavioral symptom which a person with dementia has no control over. So I think the easier way to go is if it stresses the person out, avoid it. It's not necessary. And keep it simple. Whatever that's comforting for that patient helps the most.
Dealing with the depressed caregiver, or to ensure that the caregiver doesn't become depressed. What are coping mechanisms?
I guess dealing with caregivers, I think all of us can speak for that, no? There is an NGO called Alzheimer's Disease Foundation. There are many NGOs, religious communities, churches, temples, and various organizations that do a lot of community work. So it's important for a caregiver to have a network of support among themselves as friends, you know, just taking time out and finding who in their network they can identify as a source of support, whether those friends are just listeners, good enough, those friends are doers, or those friends are someone that just help you relax. because taking time out is very important. Caregiving for people with dementia is definitely higher. There's a higher burden because of a lot of behavioral and psychological symptoms. So the risk of depression is higher. A person has to give themselves permission to accept and let go and take that time off and carve that time off for themselves without feeling guilt.
Interesting question here from someone. Are there any studies as to why some old people are doing better than the others? What are they doing right?
Should we start with genes again?
Yes, genes.
So coming back actually to the question that Mira asked earlier was what kind of research are we doing in University of Malaya? So what Dr. Lim and I are doing is actually we're looking at genetic factors, genetic risk factors that could be causing someone to develop Parkinson's disease. And so there's always this question as to why do you have, 75-year-old people who are super, alert and aging really well, and you have others who develop these late-onset neurodegenerative diseases. So one of the ways that we're trying to answer the issue is by looking at it from a genetic angle. So there are, and it is known that in all of us, we have certain changes in our DNA that put us at higher risk of certain diseases, not just neurodegenerative diseases, but like cancer. If you think of, you can think of your uncle who smokes, two packs of cigarettes a day but has no lung cancer, and then you have, another person who seemingly has a healthy lifestyle, never smoked before, and they develop lung cancer. And so they have, perhaps in their genetic profile, in their DNAs, some changes that are predisposing them to develop these diseases. The thing about neurodegenerative diseases is that it's a very complex disease. So you can't just say, well, I've got lucky genes. It's not just about your genes. You can have the most unlucky genes, but if you have the right environment and you don't get exposed to all sorts of toxins that we're exposed to nowadays, and you have a healthy lifestyle, then you may not develop that disease. And you may have really, really good genes, but just really unlucky environment, and then go on to develop those diseases as well. So just in summary, people are trying to understand why that there are some individuals who age well. And actually, there is some research that's being done, and they're collecting, people who are age 90 years and above. They are healthy, they are cognitively well above what you would think they would be like at 90 years old. And they're trying to understand, what are these super ages? What are the changes in their DNA that they have, and try to understand how that could be contributing to how they are.
Okay, we're running out of time. Would you have a quick message for us, Dr. Lim?
So I think to add on to what Dr. Aslina has said, no doubt, for many diseases, genetic factors play an important role, and we can't change this, not yet, but also environmental factors. So you've heard about exercise. The other major cardiovascular risk factors, deserve special mention. So smoking, not smoking, diabetes, and the other major one is hypertension.
With that, thank you very much, Dr. Aslina, Dr. Bharathi, Dr. Lim Shun Yang, and Dr. Tan Maw Pin. Thank you very much.
Thank you, dear.
Thank you.
This is an edited recording of the panel session from the recent BFM Health and Living Live 2017 by AIA Vitality. This event is presented by AIA, the real life company.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.